Saturday, Disc 9.
Rodney puts chlorhexidine on and around the wound and applies a small dressing. It's at this point that Henry takes over. He prefers to do the head dressing himself. He releases one by one the pins of the head clamp. He takes three opened-out large gauze swabs and places them flat on Baxter's head. Around the head, he lays two gauze swabs, left long. Holding the five swabs in place with his left hand, he begins to wind a long crepe bandage around Baxter's head while supporting it against his waist. It's technically and physically difficult, avoiding the two drains and preventing the head from dropping down. When at last the head bandage is in place and secured, everyone in the theatre, the whole firm, converges on Baxter. This is the stage at which the patient's identity is restored, when a small area of violently revealed brain is returned to the possession of the entire person. This unwrapping of the patient marks a return to life, and if he hadn't seen it many hundred times before, Henry feels he could almost mistake it for tenderness. While Emily and Joan are carefully pulling away the surgical drapes from around Baxter's chest and legs, Rodney makes sure the tubes, leads and drains are not dislodged. Geeta is removing the pads taped over the patient's eyes. Jay is detaching the inflatable warming blanket from around Baxter's legs. Henry stands at the end of the table, cradling the head in his hands. The helpless body is revealed in a hospital gown and looks small on the table. The meditative falling line of the orchestral strings seems to be addressed to Baxter alone. Joan pulls a cover over him. Taking care not to tangle the extradural and subgallial drains, they turn Baxter onto his back. Rodney slots a padded horseshoe into the end of the table and Henry rests Baxter's head on it. Jay says, "You want me to keep him sedated overnight?" "No," Henry says. "Let's wake him up now." The anaesthetist will ease Baxter, simply by the withdrawal of drugs, into taking over his own breathing from the ventilator. To monitor the transition, Strauss holds in the palm of his hand a little black sack, the reservoir bag, through which Baxter's breathing will pass. Jay prefers to trust to his sense of touch rather than the electronic array on the anaesthetic machine. Perrone pulls off his latex gloves and ritually pings them across the room towards the bin. They go in. Always a good sign. He takes off his gown and stuffs that into the bin too, then, still in his hat, goes down the corridor to find a form to do his op note on. At the desk he finds the two policemen waiting and tells them that Baxter will be transferred within 10 minutes to the intensive care unit. By the time he gets back, there's a different atmosphere in the theatre. Country and Western music, Jay's taste, has replaced Samuel Barber. Emmylou Harris is singing Boulder to Birmingham. Emily and Joan are discussing a friend's wedding as they clean up the theatre. On the night shift, this dull task falls to the scrub nurses. The two anaesthetists and Rodney Brown are talking about offset mortgages and interest rates as they make the final preparations for the patient to be transferred to intensive care. Baxter lies peacefully on his back, showing no signs of consciousness yet. Henry grabs a chair and starts his notes. In the namespace he writes, known as Baxter, and in the date of birth, est age plus stroke minus 25. All the other personal details he has to leave blank. "You've got to shop around," Jay is telling Geeta and Rodney. "You're in a buyer's market."
"It's a spray-on tan," Joan says to Emily. "She's not allowed in the sun because she gets basal cell carcinomas. Now she's gone bright orange, face, hands, everything, and the wedding's on Saturday."
The chatter is soothing to Henry as he quickly writes, "External subdural, superior sagittal sinus repair. Patient prone, head elevated and in pins. Wound extended, retracted, free bone flap turned." For the past 2 hours, he's been in a dream of absorption that has dissolved all sense of time and all awareness of the other parts of his life. Even his awareness of his own existence has vanished. He's been delivered into a pure present, free of the weight of the past or any anxieties about the future. In retrospect, though never at the time, it feels like profound happiness. It's a little like sex, in that he feels himself in another medium, but it's less obviously pleasurable and clearly not sensual. This state of mind brings a contentment he never finds with any passive form of entertainment. Books, cinema, even music can't bring him to this. Working with others is one part of it, but it's not all. This benevolent dissociation seems to require difficulty, prolonged demands on concentration and skills, pressure, problems to be solved, even danger. He feels calm and spacious, fully qualified to exist. It's a feeling of clarified emptiness, of deep, muted joy. Back at work and lovemaking and Theo's song aside, he's happier than at any other point on his day off, his valuable Saturday. There must, he concludes as he stands to leave the theatre, be something wrong with him. He takes the lift one floor down and goes along a polished, dim corridor to the neurological ward where he makes himself known to the nurse on duty. Then he walks in and pauses outside a four-bed room to look through the glass. Seeing a reading light on above the nearest bed, he opens the door quietly and goes in. She's sitting up, writing in a notebook with a pink plastic cover. As Henry sits down by her bed, and before she has had time to close her book, he notices that she's drawn for the dot of each eye a meticulous heart. She gives him a sleepy, welcoming smile. His voice is barely above a whisper. Can't sleep.
They gave me a pill, but I can't stop my mind.
I get that too. In fact, I had it last night. I was passing by, so a good time to tell you myself. The operation went really well. With her fine dark skin, her round and lovely face, and the thick crepe bandage that he wound round her head yesterday afternoon, she has a dignified, sepulchral look. An African queen. She wriggles down the bed and pulls the covers round her shoulders like a child preparing to hear a familiar bedtime story. She hugs her notebook to her chest.
Did you get it all out like you said?
It came out like a dream. It rolled out. Every last bit.
What's that word you said before about how it's going to go?
He's intrigued. Her change in manner, her communicative warmth, the abandonment of the hard street talk can't simply be down to her medication or tiredness. The area he was operating in, the vermis, has no bearing on emotional function. Prognosis, he tells her.
Right. So, Doctor, what's the prognosis?
Excellent. Your chances of a total recovery are 100%. She shrugs herself deeper into the bed covers.
I love hearing you say that. Do it again.
He obliges, making his voice as sonorous and authoritative as he can. He's decided that whatever's changed in Andrea Chapman's life is written down in her notebook. He taps its cover with a finger.
What do you like to write about? It's a secret,
she says quickly. But her eyes are bright and her lips part as if she's about to speak. Then she changes her mind and clamps them shut and with a mischievous look stares past him at the ceiling. She's dying to tell. He says,
I'm very good at secrets.
You have to be when you're a doctor.
You tell no one, right?
Right.
You solemnly promise on the Bible.
I promise to tell no one.
It's this, right? I've decided I'm going to be a doctor.
Brilliant.
A surgeon, a brain surgeon.
Even better. But get used to calling yourself a neurosurgeon.
Right. A neurosurgeon. Everybody stand back. I'm going to be a neurosurgeon.
No one will ever know how many real or imagined medical careers are launched in childhood during post-operative days. Over the years, a few kids have divulged such an ambition to Henry Perrone on his rounds, but no one has quite burned with it the way Andrea Chapman does now. She's too excited to lie covered up. She struggles up the bed, plants her elbow on the mattress, and as best she can, with her drain still in place, rests her head on her hand. Her gaze is lowered and she's thinking carefully before asking her question.
Have you just been doing an operation?
Yes. A man fell downstairs and whacked his head. But it's not the patient she's interested in.
Was Dr. Brown there?
Yes, he was. Finally, she looks up at Henry with an expression of pleading honesty. They are at the heart of her secret.
Isn't he just a wonderful doctor?
Oh, he's very good. The best. You like him, do you? Unable to speak, she nods, and he waits a good while. You're in love with him. At the utterance of the sacred words, she flinches, then quickly checks his face for mockery. She finds him impenetrably grave. He says delicately,
"You don't think he's a little old for you?" "I'm 14," she protests. "Rodney's only 31. And the thing is this..."
She's sitting up now, still pressing her pink book to her chest, joyous to be addressing at last the only true subject.
"He comes and sits where you are, and says to me about how if I want to be a doctor, I need to get serious about studying and that, and stop clubbing and that, and he doesn't even know what's happening between us. It's happening without him. He's got no idea. I mean, he's older than me, he's this important surgeon and everything, but he's so innocent."
She outlines her plans. As soon as she's qualified as a consultant, in 25 years' time, by Henry's private calculation, she'll be joining Rodney in Guyana to help him run his clinic. After a further 5 minutes of Rodney, Perrone rises to leave. When he reaches the door, she says,
"Do you remember you said, like, you'd make a video of my operation?"
"Yes."
"Can I see it?"
"I suppose so. But are you really sure you want to?"
"Oh, my God! I'm going to be a neurosurgeon, remember? I really need to watch it. I want to see right inside my head. Then I'm going to have to show it to Rodney."
On his way out, Perrone lets the nurse know that Andrea is awake and lively. Then he takes the lift up to the third floor again and walks back down the long corridor that runs behind the neurosurgery suite and brings him by the main entrance to intensive care. In soothing gloom, he goes along the broad avenue of beds with their watchful machines and winking coloured lights. He's reminded of neon signs in a deserted street. The big room has the ephemeral tranquillity of a city just before dawn. At the desk, he finds the nurse in charge, Brian Reed, a Geordie busy filling out forms, and learns that all Baxter's signs are good, that he's come round and is dozing. Reed nods significantly towards the two policemen sitting in the shadows near Baxter's bed. Perrone was intending to walk home as soon as he was satisfied his patient was stable, but as he comes away from the desk, he finds himself going across. At his approach, the constables, bored or half asleep, get to their feet and politely explain that they'll wait outside in the corridor. Baxter is lying on his back, arms straight at his sides, hooked up to all the systems, breathing easily through his nose. There's no tremor in the hands, Perrone notices. Sleep is the only reprieve. Sleep and death. The head bandage doesn't ennoble Baxter the way it did Andrea. With his heavy stubble and dark swelling under the eyes, he looks like a fighter laid out by a killer punch, or an exhausted chef kipping in the storeroom between shifts. Sleep has relaxed his jaw and softened the simian effect of a muzzle. The forehead has loosened its habitual frown against the outrageous injustice of his condition and gained him some clarity in repose. Crone brings a chair over and sits down. A patient at the far end of the room calls out, perhaps in her sleep, a sharp cry of astonishment repeated three times. Without turning, he's aware of the nurse going towards her. Perrone looks at his watch. 3:30. He knows he should be going, that he must not fall asleep in the chair. But now he's here almost by accident. He has to stay a while, and he won't doze off because he's feeling too many things. He's alive to too many contradictory impulses. His thoughts have assumed a sinuous, snaking quality, driven by the same undulating power that's making the space in the long room ripple, as well as the floor beneath his chair. Feelings have become in this respect like light itself, wave-like, as they used to say in his physics class. He needs to stay here, and in his usual manner break them down into their components, the quanta, and find all the distal and proximal causes. Only then will he know what to do, what's right. He slips his hand around Baxter's wrist and feels for his pulse. It's quite unnecessary because the monitor's showing a reading in bright blue numerals, 65 beats per minute. He does it because he wants to. It was one of the first things he learned to do as a student. Simple, a matter of primal contact, reassuring to the patient, so long as it's done with unfaltering authority. Count the beats, those soft footfalls, over 15 seconds, then multiply by 4. The nurse is still up at the far end of the ward. The constables in the corridor are just visible through a window in the unit's swing doors. Far more than a quarter of a minute passes. In effect, he's holding Baxter's hand while he attempts to sift and order his thoughts and decide precisely what should be done. Rosalind has left a lamp on in the bedroom by the sofa under the mirror. The dimmer switch is turned low, and the bulb gives less light than a candle. She's lying curled on her side, with the covers bunched against her stomach and the pillows discarded on the floor, sure signs of troubled sleep. He watches her from the foot of the bed for a minute or so, waiting to see if he disturbed her as he came in. She looks young. Her hair has fallen forwards across her face, giving her a carefree, dissolute air. He goes to the bathroom and undresses in semi-darkness because he doesn't want to see himself in the mirror. The sight of his haggard face could set him off on a meditation about aging, which would poison his sleep. He takes a shower to wash away the sweat of concentration and all traces of the hospital. He imagines fine bone dust from Baxter's skull lodged in the pores of his forehead and soaps himself vigorously. As he's drying, he notices that even in poor light, the bruise on his chest is visible and appears to have spread like a stain in a cloth. It hurts less, though, when he touches it. It feels like distant memory now, months ago, when he took that blow and felt the sharp ridge of a shockwave run through his body. More insult than pain. Perhaps he should turn the light on after all and examine it. Bertie goes into the bedroom, still with his towel, and switches off the lamp. One shutter stands ajar by an inch, casting a blurred rod of soft white light across the floor and up the facing wall. He doesn't trouble himself with closing the shutter. Total darkness, sense deprivation, might activate his thoughts. Better to stare at something and hope to feel his eyelids grow heavy. Already his tiredness seems fragile or unreliable, like a pain that comes and goes. He needs to nurture it and avoid thoughts at all costs. Standing on his side of the bed, he hesitates. There's enough light to see that Rosalind has taken all the covers and has knotted them under her and against her chest. Pulling them free is bound to wake her, but it's too cold to sleep without them. He fetches from the bathroom two heavy toweling dressing gowns to use as blankets. She's sure to roll over soon, and then he'll take his share. But as he's getting into bed, she puts her hand on his arm and whispers,
"I kept dreaming it was you. Now it really is."
She lifts the covers and lets him enter the tent of her warmth. Her skin is hot, his is cool. They lie on their sides, face to face. He can barely see her, but her eyes show two points of light gathered from the tip of the white bar rising on the wall behind him. He puts his arms around her, and as she moves closer into him, he kisses her head. She says,
"You smell good."
He grunts, vaguely in gratitude. Then there's silence as they try out the possibility that they can treat this like any other disturbed night and fall asleep in each other's arms. Or perhaps they're only waiting to begin. After a little while, Henry says quietly,
"Tell me what you're feeling."
As he says this, he puts his hand on the small of her back. She breathes out sharply. He's asked her a difficult question.
"Angry,"
she tells him at last. Because she says it in a whisper, it sounds unconvincing. She adds,
"And terrified still, of them."
As he's starting to reassure her they'll never come back, she speaks over him.
"No, no. I mean, I feel they're in the room. They're still here. I'm still frightened."
He feels her legs begin to shake and he draws her closer to him and kisses her face.
"Darling," he murmurs.
"Sorry. I had this shaking earlier when I came to bed. Then it calmed down. Oh, God. I want it to stop."
He reaches down and places his hands on her legs. The shivering appears to emanate from her knees in tight, dry spasms as though her bones were grating in their joints.
"You're in shock,"
he says, as he massages her legs.
"Oh, God,"
she keeps saying, but nothing else. Several minutes pass before the trembling subsides, during which he holds her and rocks her and tells her he loves her. When she's calm at last, she says in her usual level voice,
"I'm angry too. I can't help it, but I want him punished. I mean, I hate him. I want him to die. You asked me what I felt, not what I think. That vicious, loathsome man, what he did to John, and forcing Daisy like that, and holding the knife against me, and using it to make you go upstairs. I thought I might never see you again alive."
She stops, and he waits. When she speaks again, her tone is more deliberate. They're lying face to face again, he's holding her hand, caressing her fingers with his thumb. "When I talked to you at the front door about revenge, I mean, it was my own feelings I was afraid of. I thought that in your position, I'd do something really terrible to him. I was worried that you were having the same ideas, that you'd get in serious trouble." There's so much he wants to tell her, discuss with her, but this is not the time. He knows he won't get from her the kind of response he wants. He'll do it tomorrow, when she's less upset, before the police come. With her fingertips, she finds his lips and kisses them.
"What happened in the operation?"
"It was fine. Pretty much routine. He lost a lot of blood. We patched him up. Rodney was good, but he might have had trouble dealing with it alone."
"So this person, Baxter, will live to face charges?"
Henry doesn't reply to this beyond an uncommitted nasal hum of near assent. It's useful to consider the moment he'll broach the subject. Sunday morning, coffee in large white cups, the conservatory in brilliant winter sunshine, the newspapers they deplore but always read. And as he reaches forwards to touch her hand, she looks up and he sees in her face that calm intelligence, focused, ready to forgive. He opens his eyes into darkness and discovers he's been asleep, perhaps only for a few seconds. Rosalind is saying, "He got terribly drunk, maudlin, the usual stuff. It was hard to take after everything else, but the kids were fantastic. They took him back in a taxi and a hotel doctor came out and looked at his nose." Henry has a passing sensation of travelling through the night. He and Rosalind once took a sleeper train from Marseille to Paris and squeezed into the top bunk together where they lay on their fronts to watch sleeping France go by and talk until dawn. Tonight, the conversation is the journey. In his comfortable, drifting state, he feels only warmth towards his father-in-law. He says, "He was magnificent, though. They couldn't intimidate him. And he told Daisy what to do." "He was brave, all right," she agrees. "But you were amazing. Right from the beginning I could see you planning and calculating. I saw you look across at Theo." He takes her hand and kisses her fingers. "None of us went through what you did. You were fantastic." "Daisy held me steady. She had such strength then. And Theo, too, when he came flying up those stairs." For some minutes, the events of the evening are transformed into a colourful adventure, a drama of strong wills, inner resources, new qualities of character revealed under pressure. They used to talk this way after family ascents of mountains in the West Highlands of Scotland. Things always went wrong, but interestingly, funnily. Now, suddenly animated, they exult in praise. And because it's familiar and less absurd than eulogising each other, they celebrate the children. These past two decades, Henry and Rosalind have spent many hours doing just this. Alone together, they like to gossip about their children. These latest exploits shine in the dark. When Theo grabbed his lapels, when Daisy looked him right in the eye. What lovely children these are. Such loving natures. What luck to be their parents. But the excited conversation can't last. Their words begin to sound hollow and unreal in their ears, and they begin to subside. They can't avoid for much longer the figure of Baxter at the centre of their ordeal. Cruel, weak, meaningless, demanding to be confronted. Also, they're talking about Daisy and not addressing the pregnancy. They're not quite ready, though they're close. After a pause, Henry says, "The thing is this, surely. His mind is going and he thought he was coming to settle a score. Who knows what spooky, uncontrollable emotions were driving him?" He then describes to her in detail the encounter in University Street and includes everything he thinks might be relevant. The policeman waving him on, the demonstrators in Gower Street and the funereal drumbeats. His own competitive instincts before the confrontation. While he's talking, her hand is resting on his cheek. They could turn on the lights, but it comforts them, this intimate, trusting darkness. The sexless, childlike huddling and talking into the night. Daisy and Theo used to do it on the top floor with their sleepover friends. Little voices still murmuring at 3 a.m., faltering against sleep and bravely picking up again. When Henry was 10, a cousin, a year younger, came to stay for a month while her mother was in hospital. Since he had a double bed in his room and there was nowhere else, his mother put her in with him. Henry and his cousin ignored each other during the day. Mona was plump, with thick lenses in her specs and a missing finger. And above all, she was a girl. But on the first night, a disembodied whispering voice from a warm mound on the other side of the bed wove the epic of the school sweet factory visit, and the chocolates cascading down a chute of the machinery that turned so fast it was invisible, then the swift, painless dismemberment, the spray of blood like a feather duster that coloured the teacher's jacket, of the fainting friends, and the foreman on his hands and knees beneath the machine hunting for the missing
part.
Stirred, Henry could answer with no more than a lanced boil, but Mona was sportingly appreciative. And so they were launched in their time capsule, their short lives and some inventiveness sufficient to keep them in horrible anecdotes through the night until the summer dawn, and with different themes through other nights too. When he's finished his account of the confrontation, Rosalind says,
"Of course it wasn't an abuse of authority. They could have killed you."
This is not the conclusion he wanted her to reach. He arranged the details to prompt her in another direction. He's about to try again, but she starts a story of her own. This is the nature of these night journeys. The steps, the sequences, are not logical.
"While I was waiting for you tonight before I fell asleep, I was trying to work out just how long it was he held that knife to me. In my memory, it's no time at all. And I don't mean that it seems brief. It's no time, not in time. Not a minute or an hour. Just a fact."
As she recalls it, the tremors return, but fainter, then fade away. He holds her hand tightly.
"I wondered if it was because I felt only one thing, sheer terror. No changes, no sense of passing time. But that's not it. I did feel other things."
Her pause is long. Unable to read her expression, he hesitates to prompt her. Finally, he says, "What other things?" Her voice is reflective rather than distressed.
"You. There was you. The only other time I felt so terrified and helpless was before my operation, when I still thought I was going to go blind. When you came down with me to wait. You were so gawky and earnest. The sleeves of your white coat hardly came past your elbows. I've always said that's when I fell for you. I suppose that's right. Sometimes I think I made that up, and it was later. Then tonight an even greater terror, and there you were again, trying to talk to me with your eyes. Still there, after all the years. That's what I hung on to. You."
He feels her fingers graze across his face, then she kisses him. No longer so childlike, their tongues touch. "But it was Daisy who delivered you. She swung his mood with that poem. Arnold someone?"
"Matthew Arnold."
He's remembering her body, its pallor, the compact bump containing his grandchild, already with a heart, a self-organizing nervous system, a swelling pinhead of a brain. Here's what unattended matter can get up to in the total darkness of a womb. Reading the meaning of his silence, Rosalind says,
"I talk to her again. She's in love, she's excited. She's having this baby. Henry, we have to be on her side."
"I am," he says. "We are."
His eyes are closed and he's listening intently to Rosalind. This baby's life is taking shape. A year in Paris with its enraptured parents, and then to London, where its father has been offered a good position in an important dig, a Roman villa to the east of the city. They might all move in here for a while and live on the square. Henry murmurs his assent. He's glad. The house is big, 7,000 square feet, and needs the sound of a child's voice again. He feels his body the size of a continent stretching away from him down the bed. He's a king. He's vast, accommodating, immune. He'll say yes to any plan that has kindness and warmth at its heart. Let the baby take its first steps and speak its first sentence here, in this palace. Daisy wants her baby, then let it happen in the best possible way. If she was ever going to be a poet, she'll make her poetry out of this. As good a subject as a string of lovers. He can't move his head, he can barely move his hand to stroke Rosalind's as she unfolds the future for him, the domestic arrangements. He's following closely, attending to the pleasure in her voice. The first shock is over. She's coming through. And Theo has been talking of his plans, too, which will take him away for 15 months to New York with New Blue Rider as resident band in an East Village club. It has to be. Theo's music needs it, and they'll make it work. Help him find a place. Visit him there. The king rumbles his assent. Across the square, the wail of an ambulance racing southwards down Charlotte Street rouses him a little. He pulls himself onto an elbow and moves closer so that his face is over hers. We should sleep.
Yes. The police say they're coming at 10.
But when they've finished kissing, he says, touch me. As the sweet sensation spreads through him, he hears her say,
tell me that you're mine.
I'm yours. Entirely yours.
Touch my breasts with your tongue.
Rosalind, I want you.
This is where he marks the end of his day. The moment is sharper, more piercing than Saturday's lazy, affectionate beginning. Their movements are quick and greedy, urgent rather than joyous. It's as if they've returned from exile, emerged from a hard prison spell to gorge at a feast. Their appetites are noisy, their manners are rough. They can't quite trust their luck, they want all they can get in a short time. They also know that at the end, after they've reclaimed each other, is the promise of oblivion. At one point she whispers to him,
my darling one, we could have been killed and we're alive.
They are alive for love, but only briefly. The end comes in a sudden fall, so concentrated in its pleasure that it's excruciating to endure, unbearably intrusive, like nerve ends being peeled and stripped clean. Afterwards, they don't immediately move apart. They lie still in the dark, feeling their heartbeat slow. Henry experiences his exhaustion and the sudden clarity of sexual release merge into a single fact, dry and flat as a desert. He must begin to cross it now, alone. And he doesn't mind. At last, they say goodnight by means of a single squeeze of hands. They feel too raw for kisses. Then Rosalind turns on her side and within seconds is breathing deeply. Oblivion doesn't come to Henry Perrone quite yet. He may have reached the point at which tiredness itself prevents sleep. He lies on his back, patiently waiting, head turned towards the bar of white light on the wall, aware of an inconvenient pressure growing in his bladder. After several minutes, he takes one of the dressing gowns from the floor and goes into the bathroom. The marble floor is icy underfoot. The open curtains on the tall north-facing windows show a few stars in a sky of broken orange-tinted cloud. It's 5:15, and already there's a rustle of traffic on the Euston Road. When he's relieved himself, he bends over the wash basin to drink deeply from the cold water tap. Back in the bedroom, he hears a distant rumble of an airplane, the first of the morning rush hour into Heathrow, he supposes, and, drawn by the sound, goes to the window he stood at before and opens the shutters. He prefers to stand here a few minutes looking out than to lie still in bed, forcing sleep. Quietly he raises the window. The air is warmer than last time, but still he shivers. The light is softer too. The features of the square, especially the branches of the plane trees in the garden, are not so etched and seem to merge with each other. What can it be about low temperatures that sharpens the edges of objects? The benches have lost their expectant air. The litter bins have been emptied. The paving has been swept clean. The energetic team in yellow jackets must have been through during the evening. Henry tries to find reassurance in this orderliness and in remembering the square at its best. Weekday lunchtimes, in warm weather when the office crowds from the local production, advertising and design companies bring their sandwiches and boxed salads and the gates of the gardens are opened up. They loll on the grass in quiet groups. Men and women of various races, mostly in their 20s and 30s, confident, cheerful, unoppressed, fit from private gym workouts, at home in their city. So much divides them from the various broken figures that haunt the benches. Work is one outward sign. It can't just be class or opportunities. The drunks and junkies come from all kinds of backgrounds, as do the office people. Some of the worst wrecks have been privately educated. Perrone, the professional reductionist, can't help thinking it's down to invisible folds and kinks of character written in code at the level of molecules. It's a dim fate to be the sort of person who can't earn a living or resist another drink or remember today what he resolved to do yesterday. No amount of social justice will cure or disperse this enfeebled army haunting the public places of every town. So what then? Henry draws his dressing gown more closely around him. You have to recognize bad luck when you see it. You have to look out for these people. Some you can prize from their addictions, others, all you can do is make them comfortable somehow. Minimize their miseries. Somehow. He's no social theorist, and of course he's thinking of Baxter, that unpickable knot of affliction. It may be the thought of him that makes Henry feel shaky, or the physical effects of tiredness. He has to put his hand on the sill to steady himself. He feels himself turning on a giant wheel, like the eye on the south bank of the Thames, just about to arrive at the highest point. He's poised on a hinge of perception before the drop, and he can see ahead calmly. Or it's the eastward turn of the earth, he imagines, delivering him towards the dawn at a stately 1,000 miles an hour. If he counts on sleep rather than the clock to divide the days, then this is still his Saturday, dropping far below him, as deep as a lifetime. And from here, from the top of his day, he can see far ahead, before the descent begins. Sunday doesn't ring with the same promise and vigour as the day before. The square below him, deserted and still, gives no clues to the future. But from where he stands up here, there are things he can see that he knows must happen. Soon, it will be his mother's time. The message will come from the home. Or they'll send for him and he and his family will be sitting by her bed, in her tiny room, with her ornaments, drinking the thick brown tea, watching the last of her, the husk of the old swimmer, shrink into the pillows. At the thought he feels nothing now, but he knows the sorrow will surprise him, because it's happened once before. There came a time in her decline when at last he had to move her out of her house, the old family home where he grew up and into care. The disease was obliterating the housewifely routines she had once kept faith with. She left the oven on all night with the butter dish inside. She hid the front door key from herself down cracks in the floorboards. She confused shampoo and bleach. All these, and moments of existential bewilderment at finding herself in a street or in a shop or someone's house with no knowledge of where she had come from, who these people were, where she lived and what she was supposed to do next. A year later she had forgotten her life as well as her old house. But arranging to sell it felt like a betrayal, and Henry made no move. He and Rosalind checked on it, his childhood home, from time to time, and he mowed the lawn in summer. Everything remained in its place, waiting. The yellow rubber gloves hanging from their wooden clothes peg, the drawer of iron dusters and tea towels, the glazed pottery donkey bearing a pannier of toothpicks. A vegetable odour of neglect began to gather. A shabbiness invaded her possessions that had nothing to do with dust. Even from the road, the house had a defeated look, and when kids put a stone through the living room window one afternoon in November, he knew he must act. Rosalind and the children came with him to clear the place one weekend. They all chose a memento. It seemed disrespectful not to. Daisy had a brass plate from Egypt, Theo a carriage clock, Rosalind a plain china fruit bowl. Henry took a shoebox of photographs. Other pieces went to nephews and nieces. Lily's bed, her sideboard, two wardrobes, and the carpets and the chests of drawers were waiting for a house-clearing firm. The family packed up clothes and kitchenware and unwanted ornaments for the charity shops. Henry never realised before how these places lived off the dead. Everything else they stuffed into bin liners and put out for the rubbish collection. They worked in silence, like looters. Having the radio on wasn't appropriate. It took a day to dismantle Lily's existence. They were striking the set of a play, a humble, one-handed domestic drama without permission from the cast. They started in what she called her sewing room, his old room. She was never coming back. She no longer knew what knitting was, but wrapping up her scores of needles, her thousand patterns, a baby's half-finished yellow shawl to give them all away to strangers, was to banish her from the living. They worked quickly, almost in a frenzy. She's not dead, Henry kept telling himself. But her life, all lives, seemed tenuous when he saw how quickly, with what ease, all the trappings, all the fine details of a lifetime could be packed and scattered, or junked. Objects became junk as soon as they were separated from their owner and their pasts. Without her, her old tea cosy was repellent, with its faded farmhouse motif and pale brown stains on cheap fabric, and stuffing that was pathetically thin. As the shelves and drawers emptied, and the boxes and bags filled, he saw that no one owned anything really. It's all rented, or borrowed. Our possessions will outlast us. We'll desert them in the end. They worked all day and put out 23 bags for the dustman. He feels skinny and frail in his dressing gown, facing the morning that's still dark, still part of yesterday. Yes, that will happen, and he'll make the arrangements. She walked him once to a cemetery near her house to show him the rows of small metal lockers set into a wall where she wanted her ashes put. All that's bound to happen, and they'll stand with bowed heads listening to the burial of the dead. Or will they have it for cremations? Man that is born of woman hath but a short time to live. He's heard it often over the years, but remembers only fragments. He fleeth as it were a shadow, cut down like a flower. Yes, and then it will be the turn of John Grammaticus, one of those transfiguring illnesses that come to a drinking man, or a terminal stab to heart or brain. They'll all take that hard in their different ways, though Henry less than others. The old poet was brave tonight, pretending not to suffer with his nose, giving Daisy just the right prompt. And when it comes, then there'll be the crisis of the chateau if Teresa marries John and stakes her claim, and Rosalind, formidable in law, pursues her rights to the place her mother made, the place where Daisy, Theo, and Rosalind herself spent their childhood summers. And Henry's role? Wise and implacable loyalty. What else beyond the dying? Theo will make his first move from home. There'll be no postcards or letters or emails, only phone calls. There'll be trips to New York to listen to him and his band bring their blues to the Americans. They might not like it. And a chance to see old friends from Bellevue Hospital days. And Daisy will publish her poems and produce a baby and bring Julio. Henry still sees the dark-skinned, bare-chested lover from the poem he misheard. A baby and its huge array of materiel to enliven the household, and someone else, not him, not Rosalind, getting up in the night. And not Julio, unless he's an unusual Italian. All this is rich. And then he, Henry, will turn 50 and give up squash and marathons. The house will empty when Daisy and Julio find a place and Theo gets one too. And Henry and Rosalind will collapse in on each other, cling tighter. Their business of raising children, launching young adults over. That restlessness, that hunger he's had lately for another kind of life, will fade. The time will come when he does less operating and more administration. There's another kind of life, and Rosalind will leave the paper to write her book. And a time will come when they find they no longer have the strength for the square, the junkies, and the traffic din and dust. Perhaps a bomb in the cause of jihad will drive them out with all the other faint hearts into the suburbs, or deeper into the country, or to the chateau. Their Saturday will become a Sunday. Behind him, as though agitated by his thoughts, Rosalind flinches, moans, and moves again before she falls silent and he turns back to the window. London, his small part of it, lies wide open, impossible to defend, waiting for its bomb like 100 other cities. Rush hour will be a convenient time. It might resemble the Paddington crash. Twisted rails buckled, upraised commuter coaches, stretchers handed out through broken windows, the hospital's emergency plan in action. Berlin, Paris, Lisbon. The authorities agree, an attack's inevitable. He lives in different times. Because the newspapers say so doesn't mean it isn't true. But from the top of his day, this is a future that's harder to read, a horizon indistinct with possibilities. 100 years ago, a middle-aged doctor standing at this window in his silk dressing gown less than 2 hours before a winter's dawn might have pondered the new century's future. February 1903. You might envy this Edwardian gent all he didn't yet know. If he had young boys, he could lose them within a dozen years at the Somme. And what was their body count? Hitler, Stalin, Mao. 50 million? 100? If you described the hell that lay ahead, if you warned him, the good doctor, an affable product of prosperity and decades of peace, would not believe you. Beware the utopianists, zealous men certain of the path to the ideal social order. Here they are again, totalitarians in different form, still scattered and weak, but growing, and angry, and thirsty for another mass killing. 100 years to resolve. But this may be an indulgence, an idle, overblown fantasy, a night thought about a passing disturbance that time and good sense will settle and rearrange. The nearer ground, the nearest promontory, is easier to read. As sure as his mother's death, he'll be dining with Professor Taleb in an Iraqi restaurant near Hoxton. The war will start next month. The precise date must already have been fixed, as though for any big outdoor sporting event. Any later in the season will be too hot for killing or liberation. Baghdad is waiting for its bombs. Where's Henry's appetite for removing a tyrant now? At the end of this day, this particular evening, he's timid, vulnerable. He keeps drawing his dressing gown more tightly around him. Another plane moves left to right across his view, descending in its humdrum way along the line of the Thames towards Heathrow. Harder now to recall or to inhabit the vigour of his row with Daisy. The certainties have dissolved into debating points. That the world the professor described is intolerable, that however murky American motives, some lasting good and fewer deaths might come from dismantling it. Might, he hears Daisy tell him, is not good enough, and you've let one man's story turn your head. A woman bearing a child has her own authority. Will he revive his hopes for firm action in the morning? All he feels now is fear. He's weak and ignorant, scared of the way consequences of an action leap away from your control and breed new events, new consequences, until you're led to a place you never dreamed of and would never choose. A knife at the throat. One floor down from where Andrea Chapman dreams of being carried away by the improbable love of a young doctor and of becoming one herself, lies Baxter in his private darkness, watched over by the constables. But one small fixed point of conviction holds Henry steady. It began to take form at dinner, before Jay rang, and was finally settled when he sat in intensive care feeling Baxter's pulse. He must persuade Rosalind, then the rest of the family, then the police, not to pursue charges. The matter must be dropped. Let them go after the other man. Baxter has a diminishing slice of life worth living before his descent into nightmare hallucination begins. Henry can get a colleague or two specialists in the field to convince the Crown Prosecution Service that by the time it comes round, Baxter will not be fit to stand trial. This may or may not be true. Then the system, the right hospital, must draw him in securely before he does more harm. Henry can make these arrangements, do what he can to make the patient comfortable somehow. Is this forgiveness? Probably not. He doesn't know, and he's not the one to be granting it anyway. Or is he the one seeking forgiveness? He's responsible after all. 20 hours ago, he drove across a road officially closed to traffic and set in train a sequence of events. Or it could be weakness. After a certain age, when the remaining years first take on their finite aspect, and you begin to feel for yourself the first chill, you watch a dying man with a closer, more brotherly interest. But he prefers to believe that it's realism. They'll all be diminished by whipping a man on his way to hell. By saving his life in the operating theatre, Henry also committed Baxter to his torture. Revenge enough. And here is one area where Henry can exercise authority and shape events. He knows how the system works. The difference between good and bad care is near infinite. Daisy recited a poem that cast a spell on one man. Perhaps any poem would have done the trick and thrown the switch on a sudden mood change. Still, Baxter fell for the magic. He was transfixed by it, and he was reminded how much he wanted to live. No one can forgive him the use of the knife. But Baxter heard what Henry never has, and probably never will, despite all Daisy's attempts to educate him. Some 19th-century poet, Henry has yet to find out whether this Arnold is famous or obscure, touched off in Baxter a yearning he could barely begin to define. That hunger is his claim on life, on a mental existence, and because it won't last much longer, because the door of his consciousness is beginning to close, he shouldn't pursue his claim from a cell, waiting for the absurdity of his trial to begin. This is his dim, fixed fate, to have one tiny slip, an error of repetition in the codes of his being, in his genotype, the modern variant of a soul, and he must unravel. Another certainty Henry sees before him. Quietly, he lowers the window. The morning is still dark, and it's the coldest time now. The dawn won't come until after 7. 3 nurses are walking across the square, talking cheerfully, heading in the direction of his hospital to start their morning shift. He closes the shutters on them, then goes towards the bed and lets the dressing gown fall to his feet as he gets in. Rosalind lies facing away from him, with her knees crooked. He closes his eyes. This time there'll be no trouble falling towards oblivion. There's nothing can stop him now. Sleep's no longer a concept. It's a material thing, an ancient means of transport, a softly moving belt conveying him into Sunday. He fits himself around her silk pyjamas, her scent, her warmth, her beloved form, and draws closer to her. Blindly he kisses her nape. "There's always this," is one of his remaining thoughts. And then, "There's only this." And at last, faintly, falling, "This day's over."
The End. You've been listening to Saturday by Ian McEwan, narrated by Stephen Crossley and directed by T.G. Reynolds. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Magic Seeds by V.S. Naipaul, narrated by Asif Mandvi. This stunning novel of the present moment takes us into the hearts and minds of those who use terrorism as an ideal and a way of life, and those who aspire to the frightening power of wealth. Magic Seeds is a moving tale of a man searching for his life and fearing he has wasted it, and a testing study of the conflicts between the rich and the poor, and the struggles within each. V.S. Naipaul's spare, elegant prose sizzles with devastating psychological analysis, bleak humour, and astonishing characters. At once so attuned to the world, and so much a challenge to it. We also recommend The Plot Against America by Philip Roth, narrated by Ron Silver. Renowned aviation hero and rabid isolationist Charles A. Lindbergh, immediately upon taking office as the 33rd President of the United States, negotiates a cordial understanding with Adolf Hitler, after publicly blaming the Jews for pushing the country toward a pointless war with Germany. Imagining the defeat of Franklin Roosevelt in the 1940 presidential election, Philip Roth recounts what it was like for his Newark family, and for a million such families all over the country, during the menacing years of the Lindbergh presidency, when American citizens who happened to be Jews had every reason to expect the worst. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call the toll-free number found on the back of this book. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse our catalogue, place orders, hear about our latest releases, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.